So I was on that call with Gary V, Logan Paul, Mr. Beast.
Gary V, it's like 11 p.m. just out of nowhere, just calls me. And he's like, yo, I got like 30 people to call, hop in.
Every heavy hitter you can imagine exactly. who's worth $1 billion was on this one call.
Oh, I was all in. Very quickly, Gary and AJ and a few others, you know, myself included, fell in love with CryptoPunks. It was like an ungodly amount of money for a JPEG, like $20,000 for like a picture. I remember sitting down with my wife, Kat, saying like, this is like, you're not going to like this conversation. There's nothing I can say that's going to get you like over the hump and loving what I just did.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to My Social Life. I'm your host, Jacob Kelly. As always, today's podcast is powered by Surf. And today on the podcast, we are joined by Michael Lazaro. Michael is the co-founder and managing partner of Velvet Sea Ventures, the co-founder of Buddy Media, which was acquired by Salesforce in 2012. And today he is spending an increasing amount of time in the Web3 space, having over $400 million worth of assets under management in the space. And I cannot be more excited to have him here on the podcast today. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm excited to have you here. And where I want to start, I want to kind of go back to the beginning here. And from my understanding, from everything that the Googling I did, the research I did last night before we did this, you are a purebred entrepreneur as it gets. I have a quote here of yours. It says, if you took a knife and cut my arm, entrepreneurship would run out. Where does this come from? I know that you have some influence from your grandfather, who was a builder of low-income housing in Baltimore. Like, where does this entrepreneurship come from within you?
You've really done your research, went back to the Baltimore days. So I grew up in the DC area, and most of the people I respected worked for themselves. And, you know, it was DC before tech, the whole like Reston, Virginia, and, you know, AOL hadn't launched, obviously. Not obviously, I'm old, point that out. But I grew up before the internet, before AOL, and everyone I really looked up to kind of did their own thing. It wasn't really a 9-to-5 type of community. Now, the entrepreneurs were more of, you know, lawyers and, you know, small real estate developers and doctors who own their own practices. So I wasn't really exposed to the tech entrepreneurs till much later, but I knew very early on that I wanted to do my own thing, which to me just meant not sitting behind a desk all day and doing other people's work. And so very quickly, I remember as a kid, I wanted to be entrepreneurial. I wanted to kind of, you know, make my own money, and started with kind of shoveling driveways. And, you know, then freshman year, sophomore year of college, you know, got my first idea for a company and launched it. And then, you know, really with the advent of the internet, it just became so obvious that this was a fundamental shift in everything, how we communicate, how we work, how we, you know, consume information. And so as a journalism student at Northwestern University, instead of becoming a reporter, I dove into my own ventures.
I'm curious, knowing that you wanted to be an entrepreneur, what led to you going to school for journalism?
So I went to journalism school because it was the only school I got into. So it wasn't, you know, growing up in the DC area, Northwestern wasn't Northwestern like it is today. And so not many people in my class applied. Two of them, you know, two people applied and we both got in. It wasn't a very popular school at the time. It's 1992. I thought Northwestern was in Seattle. As soon as I got rejected by some of the other schools, I kind of had to figure out, you know, hey, what is this Northwestern thing? I knew that the best way in for me, at least, was through the journalism school. I was very active, you know, writer, you know, campus newspaper, media. I interned at a bunch of publications during the summer. And so it seemed kind of a logical way in. And I also was told it was the only school at Northwestern that really wasn't paying attention to SAT scores. Let's just say that standardized testing is not one of my strengths, not one of my superpowers. I did not do very well. I was going through a bunch of papers. They're actually sitting right behind me. And yeah, I'm kind of embarrassed with two kids going to college what my SAT scores were.
So if standardized tests aren't your superpower, what is?
I think it's just hard work. You know, I remember as a young, you know, man, just working hard. And so when I put my mind to something, whether it was like learning to play the drums, which I did throughout, you know, high school and then college, or work, I could just get a lot of stuff done and I enjoyed it. So I enjoyed being productive. I thought there was, you know, some honor in hard work. So I could definitely hustle. I think I have good people skills. So, you know, listening to others and really understanding what motivates them is key as an entrepreneur. So as you look at hiring people, how do you not only bring people on, but give them a career path within your organization that aligns to what who they want to become as an individual? You know, obviously sales. So it's part of everything you do, even as an investor, right? You look at all the entrepreneurs, the ones that most investors want to back can take money from anyone. And so we need to show up and say, here is what we offer. Here's what we bring to the table. And it's got to be more than money. And so, you know, I could hustle, I can get things done, I can connect with people. That those have been kind of, at least in business, the true superpowers.
And were most of, like, obviously talked about entrepreneurship came naturally to you very early, but did the people skills, did the salesmanship, did that come naturally, or did you develop on those over time as you went through your career?
I think, like everyone, you just get better over time. So I too was, you know, I remember being nervous at meetings and wanting to over prepare and not seem like I was an idiot. And I've always had this preparation gene. So I like showing up prepared. I like doing my research. I like understanding who is this person who I'm speaking to. And it's just driven me to kind of, you know, by preparing, I just get better at preparing. And so, you know, I look at everything that I work on a daily basis right now, and I've just gotten better over the years, specifically at connecting with people, but also at the other skill sets.
So you had three primary companies prior to today, right? You had University Wire, Golf.com, and BuddyBedia.
Correct. Those were the two, the product companies. We had Lazaro Ventures, which was a, you know, consulting company. And we have obviously Velvet Sea Ventures, which we started, which feels like a company, but it's, you know, on the investment side.
And all three, so of the product companies, University Wire, Golf.com, BuddyBedia, all three were acquired, correct?
They were. The first one went public and then acquired. It's since been acquired, but UWire and Student Advantage went public in 1999, right before the big crash of 2000. So, you know, timing's everything. We decided to go public 4 months before the biggest crash the NASDAQ had ever seen. And so, you know, I only bring that up because we've lived through stock market crash of 2000 and, you know, 9/11, where we had golf.com and the financial meltdown of, you know, BuddyBedia. So I seem to attract kind of, you know, turbulent environments to start, you know, companies, which has only helped me operate in difficult times.
And so with BuddyBedia, you weren't planning on selling, like you weren't building it to be acquired, right?
No, we thought we were going public. We'd raised $100 million. We had just built out our management team, CFO, and our president, Susan St. Ledger, who's gone on to do incredible things at Okta and a bunch of other companies. She was at Salesforce for 12 years before she came to BuddyBedia. She came to BuddyBedia and then kind of boomerang back after, you know, Salesforce bought the company. But we had $50 million in the bank when we sold the business. We were, you know, it was go, go, go. We had offices all over the world, from Singapore to, you know, London, many in the US. So LA, San Francisco, Chicago, New York obviously was our headquarters, hundreds of employees, growing revenue fast. I think we were one of the fastest software companies to reach $50 million in annualized revenue. You know, we did in just a few years on the back of the social media growth. And so we thought we were going public. We just happened to get some inbound calls from some really big companies who made it clear that we weren't going public and they really wanted to buy us. So we ended up, ended up doing the deal with Salesforce because we loved the business. We modeled Buddy Media off of Salesforce, you know, really off of, you know, how Mark Benioff built his organization. And so it was both a great financial win, but also just personally for me and then for all their employees, it was really the perfect place to land. And it was just not only a phenomenal experience, but many of the my partners at Buddy Media still are at Salesforce. So over 10 years later, Patrick Stokes, EVP at Salesforce, running, you know, a lot of their big products. So it really turned out to be a great, you know, great win all around, I think.
And you moved over as well with the acquisition. You were chief marketing officer there for a while, right?
Yeah, I did a bunch of stuff. So chief marketing officer of the marketing cloud, helped build the marketing side of the business. So they had like the sales cloud, the service cloud, we were the marketing cloud. I also served in a role called chief strategy officer, which really was working with the largest customers at the time, companies like Unilever and Ford and just massive, massive businesses, and help them reimagine kind of their business strategy around customers. So how would you, you know, really kind of rethink your business if you were to put the customer at the center? And a lot of that work actually is why I'm so excited about Web3, because that customer is also the owner, the builder, the marketer. You know, feels very natural for those of us who came out of, you know, enterprise software and the social media and social software, because it was always about how do you put the customer at the center and help them get the most out of their relationship with you.
I do want to talk about Web3, but there's one thing I want to ask you about before we do. So you sell, make the decision to sell Buddy Media. You sign the paperwork for the acquisition. 2 hours later, you decide to film a video that you upload to YouTube. I'm curious what led to you. That was a video, A New Beginning is Fear Holding You Back. I'm curious why you decided to film that video in that moment.
So it's a really good question, and I've yet to come up with a good answer, because a lot of this stuff you do, you just do. And I was very present. It was a Sunday. I was in the office. There's no one else in the office. And, you know, we'd worked on this deal for 3 months at this point. We finally had signed it. There's nothing else I can do. But, you know, I was just hit by a bunch of emotions. And one of those emotions was kind of like how lucky I was at that time. And it wasn't just luck in business, although I think I've been one of the most fortunate people on the face of the earth. It really was just lucky in life. And, you know, I was born with a congenital heart defect. I had 2 open heart surgeries. I shouldn't be here, really. And I say that not facetiously. You know, I was in heart failure as a baby. I had an aortic valve that burst, which had to be, you know, replaced in an emergency surgery, which if they didn't get that valve in, I would not be here, right? And so I had this, through a miracle of timing and modern medicine, had survived and been able to do all this stuff and experience all these things in business and in life. Many others were not as fortunate. Not only people, you know, in this country, but if I didn't have the medical care and the timing that I had, it would have been, you know, church for me. And so I thought specifically about 2 people. One is Ben Breedlove, who I'd gotten to know his family because he had, you know, similarly had some heart issues. And he, you know, was hit by one of his videos that he put out there, which talked about this vision he had of meeting Kid Cudi. And these videos were found after he passed away, and they were, you know, the videos themselves with, you know, very similar style with these note cards. It was just very poignant how he, you know, explained these dreams that he was having, which almost, you know, was his, you know, looking at his life and his death, his imminent death. I was fortunate to get to know his family after the fact. I reached out to the Breedloves, who live in Austin, and you know, they're my awesome family still. And Jen Goodman Lynn, who was a starter, who founded Cycle for Survival after she had just an awful diagnosis of sarcoma, volleyball sized tumor in her stomach, a year after she got married to my friend Dave Lynn, instead of feeling sorry for herself, she started Cycle for Survival, which now has raised close to $320 million for cancer research. 100% goes to cancer research. Started with one ride that she took over a spin studio in the Equinox in Times Square, in the Time Warner Center. And she became kind of the spirit animal of Buddy Media. So Buddy Media was the first, you know, corporate team at Cycle for Survival. She would come to speak to the team. And every time kind of Fearless Jen came by, it just fired up the team. And we raised a lot of money and we kind of helped create the initial explosion that was Cycle. And so after all of, you know, this business stuff and this kind of like, you work on these deals and then you kind of like sign it. And you're like, what's next? I just went very internal for the first time in a while. So instead of trying to like herd the cats and figure out what I need to do, it was the first time I could actually look inside. And then, you know, obviously my good fortune, not only in business, but in life with my partner Cass and, you know, the kids. And that's basically, I just wanted to channel that somehow. And that's what came out. High douchebag factor. I don't know if I'd do it again, but it just kind of happened. It resonated and got, you know, went viral through, you know, really the media and then just people sharing it.
Why do you think that moment was the first time you were able to kind of look internally?
Well, it was the first time in a while because I was, when you work on these big transactions, these big, they're life-changing, right? We'd made money, but like we sold it for close to $1 billion. So it was like next level for us in many ways, both in kind of, you know, scale and the job we were going to have at Salesforce and the platform we were being given. And so, you know, I get paranoid around deals and I get very detail oriented. I become a control freak and I really kind of, you know, hyper focus on what needs to be done to just push it forward to the next step. And so you do that for an extended period of time. You know, if you think about this, like I have investors who think we're going public. I have conversations with Salesforce. I meet with, you know, Mark Benioff at his townhouse, and he basically says that he's buying the business, which was cool with me because I really loved him just as a leader and person. Now I have to explain it to my investors who some had just invested a few months ago, why it made sense. And, you know, and so it's just from that moment to the time we closed, just, you know, you don't really, your needs aren't really top of mind. So I start eating poorly. I don't work out. I get cranky. I don't sleep. So I think all of that was coming out.
One thing, looking kind of back at your career, you've been at the cutting edge throughout very different shifts in the industry. You know, you built businesses in Web 1, built businesses invested Web 2, built businesses invested Web 3. I know you were on Instagram very early. I think within 2 months of it launching, I believe you had an account created. So how do you stay on the cutting edge and how have you stayed on the cutting edge throughout your entire career?
I read a lot. I'm addicted to innovation. I think I've learned that over time. Like if it's been done before, it loses interest for me. So I like the idea of like, oh, this has never been done before. Like, let's do that, which isn't very practical in many cases because like people who do it first often get shot in the back and it's hard. But from a very early age, loved innovation, technology. Remember my first kind of like IBM desktop computer and trying to figure that out. And WordPerfect, and you know, I'm not that old, I'm 48, but I do remember going from typewriters to, you know, very crude word processing program, which is really the only thing that that machine did, to the first, you know, getting my first laptop, which is really thick Apple, you know, laptop, you know, cost $5,000 in 1994 and was like, you know, 1/1000th the power of your mobile phone. And yeah, I think the biggest launch that really just grabbed me, because you know, I wasn't really paying attention to the launch of the CD or the Betamax, whatever. But like the internet was powerful. Like, wow, you could like communicate with people all over the world through these like network computers, the World Wide Web. Like we used to be good at naming stuff in technology. Like, it was a pretty good name, World Wide Web. Like, oh, that's cool. Now it's like, you know, non-fungible tokens. Like, what the fuck's that? So we got to get back to like capturing people's imaginations. But I'm in college. I got not much going on. And I happen to be in the journalism school. And you could feel this idea of like, oh, this thing's going to kind of kill journalism. Like the idea that I'm going to go and be a reporter for the Chicago Tribune down the street, you know, this print publication, like it was, you could already feel that, oh, that's going to change everything. And so it was just so obvious. And a lot of people talk about this, like people who are around, you know, this is Mark Andreessen. He was, you know, at University of Illinois. You're playing with this technology. He was trying to build, if you think of what's going on today with Web3, we all know that we need a new interface, right? Like hacks every day, these ledgers. I got so many of these things on my desk. Please don't come and steal them. Like, it just makes no sense, right? Go back to the early 90s where we were just starting out. And the same thing was true of the web. Like before he launched Mosaic and then Netscape, you could not access the web. It was so difficult. There was a series of links. There was no standard browsing behavior. It was basically a hunt for files or early chat rooms, which was one of the few interfaces that people actually like used. And so, you know, Mark focused on what he's, you know, brilliant at focusing on, which is like the human computer interface. You know, I focus more on like the information flow, but it reminds me a lot of this problems that entrepreneurs are focused on right now. And, you know, same thing with social media, which became, I think it ended differently than we expected. But this idea that there are these virtual recreations of the social graph that you could tap into to do different things, whether it's gaming like Zynga or whether it's marketing like Buddy Media or other stuff. All this stuff builds on each other, right? Like you can't have the web without desktop computers. You can't have desktop without mainframes. You can't have mainframes without some of the military and government work. And so Web3 is not new. It's just standing on the shoulders of everything else. Like most of how we interact with Web3 is Web2. It's why we don't love it every day, right? Like we're in Discord. Like that's not that great. We're in Twitter, you know, the crypto Twitter. We, you know, you can't do this without the mobile phones, which didn't exist really when I started. And frankly, the iPhone is not that old. We're talking like 15 years, 2007. So like we take these for granted, like that they're just like these baby Jesus machines. But they're brand new in the history of like, if you look at the timeline of technology. And so I think like when you see a bunch of smart people interested in building stuff in that area, dive in. And all I did was I started buying NFTs. I started getting involved before other people. So this was back in mid 2020, which isn't that long ago, right? Like I'm thinking about it, I'm like, man, this is like so new. So like there's so much opportunity to dive in. Like people are like, oh, I missed the crypto boat. Like, no, today is exactly when you jump in. Because we've gone through the first crash. We still exist. Let's build. Most people will bounce, but the people who stick around will build really, really big enterprises, much bigger than you see today with some of the, you know, companies.
Was your first NFT was a CryptoPunk, right?
It was. I was on that call that people have like spoken about with the Gary V, Logan Paul, Mr. Beast. One thing I do is when smart friends send me texts like, hey, this, you should jump on this Zoom or you should show up to this dinner. Yeah, I pretty much show up unless I have a family commitment that prevents it.
And so what's your first kind of reaction to the idea of NFTs? Like when you're on that call and Gary's...
Oh, I was all in. I was all in even before that, because Gary's a very close friend who started his company in my conference room, and I know his whole family, and like, you know, there are videos of him and my kids going back and forth. Like, you know, it's a very long standing relationship. And we did a lot of work together. As if you think of who's involved with Web3, a lot of them are those of us who built Web2 companies together. And so he'd called me the previous summer, kind of having this like seizure about Jordan rookie cards, like, gotta buy Jordan rookie. And I'm like, it's like hundreds of thousands of dollars of pieces of cardboard. And I'm just not a sports card guy. Like, I like comics, I like some other stuff, but you know, I have like baseball cards that like are somewhere. I just don't get passionate. Digital stuff, the idea you could own something that's digital, immediately I got it. It was not, and you know, I'd seen some of the early work in, you know, Brooklyn. A lot of this stuff was happening in Brooklyn in 2017, 2018. John Crane and, you know, his team were building they were experimenting, right, with like Super Rare and, you know, the CryptoPunks. I'd heard of the CryptoPunks and CryptoKitties, and, you know, I'm friends with a lot of their investors who at the time I didn't quite get it as much. Like the USB team, you know, Fred and, you know, Andy Weissman. But it might have been a pandemic, but when I was sitting there saying, oh man, this is important, I immediately went to, what do I buy? And I'm like, how do I buy all of it? Because first I'm like, if I'm going to go in, let's just go in big. But then it's like, oh, don't be an idiot. Like, what do you mean? Like that makes no sense. And then very quickly, Gary and AJ and a few others, you know, myself included, fell in love with CryptoPunks. And the idea that it was this grand experiment in, you know, generative art, in traits, in... each one is unique, but together we're a community. That resonated. I mean, that's why Facebook worked. Facebook worked because you wanted to belong to your community, whatever that meant. And you wanted to be different. So, you know, I've been to a lot of Phish concerts. So I'm a Phish fan, but I'm a different Phish fan because of this, right? Like, here are the jams I like. Here's the... you know, how I've crafted my identity in that world. And so this just seemed very natural to me that like you have 10,000 unique items, but together we all have this like vested interest in like hanging out and talking. And like, you know, I wasn't really thinking about it as increasing in value, because when I bought it, it was like an ungodly amount of money for a JPEG, like $20,000 for like a picture. I remember sitting down with my wife, Kat, saying like, this is like, you're not going to like this conversation. There's nothing I can say that's going to get you like over the hump and loving what I just did. But I just did it, and just trust me, like you've trusted me along like for many years. I think that this is something. And then it went from, then you go down the rabbit hole that everyone goes down. So it's like, can't just own one. It's like the chip. Like, you can't just eat one chip. Like, you can't just buy one NFT. Then you're like buying like all these, then you're minting, and then you're looking for. And so it's like, I went from a day job of like investing to then I'd have family dinner, and then I'd like disappear in the evenings, hop on Zoom. And there are a few people who really helped, not only Gary, but Danny Mayergard, who's, you know, Seed Phrase. He owns the 7TradePunk. And I just reach out to people like, can I learn from you? Can you teach me what you're like, how you do it, what you're working on? And then I got the opportunity to, you know, invest in, you know, one of my favorite projects, which was Super Rare. And I'm still on the board, and, you know, I think have been helpful as they've moved from company to a DAO, and, you know, with the launch of the Rare token. And, you know, we don't do just crypto, but many of our big investments. And what we're really excited about is this intersection of digital ownership and industry transformation. So, you know, industries that are being kind of transformed by not just tech and the internet and mobile apps, but also digital ownership.
I want to jump back to something you said there, where you're talking about after those family dinners, you'd go, you'd lock yourself in a room, you'd jump on Zoom calls, you'd reach out to people just trying to learn. Where do you get that level of humility to ask that, to remove the ego? Because a lot of people, when they have success, they start to feel like they know everything and they don't want to go back to square one and be a beginner again. How are you able to do that? Because that's not something everyone's able to do.
Oh, I love the beginner's mind. Like, I think why I would have been a really kick-ass journalist is I love going deep. I love like getting the story. And so I start everything with, I know very little, which is true for all of us. The issue is when you make a lot of money, people think you know everything. They don't realize you just got lucky. You had good timing. You had good execution. You hustled. But that doesn't make you a genius. And it makes you the exact opposite when it comes to like capital allocation, where it doesn't involve kind of luck and hustle. It actually involves a lot of like research and like, you know, thoughtfulness, which is why I've had to learn that business, which is a whole new business. And so I start, you know, a lot of my kind of rabbit holes, and I go down a lot. You know, when I want to learn something, I go really deep. And I have to, for me, I have to like feel it. I got to be a part of the community. I have to like, it's not just books. Like I wasn't that good at like just consuming information that way. And so that, like that idea of like keeping the beginner's mind, keeping an open mind has, I think, driven a lot of my innovation, because you have to believe and see things before others. And part of believing is being open to these like ideas that are so foreign. Like the internet destroyed value for most of my career. So think about like Napster and like the music industry. Think about like, you know, newspapers and classified ads that were destroyed. Think like the internet was very destructive when it came to this. Going down the rabbit hole of Web 3, it was not only learning it, but it's like, oh, wow, there are a lot more people who are benefiting from this than just a bunch of, you know, investors and primarily white entrepreneurs, you know, who built companies in the 90s and 2000s. It's got a little more diverse. We have a long way to go.
I've heard you say that you love the energy in NFTs in the community. Is that because it's not a transactional relationship and everybody's winning, that it's not just the select few that are winning? Is that where this good energy comes from?
I think the energy comes from the idea that the best projects, and I hope that we've been involved with some of the best ones, or at least as a collector and investor, they realize that like NFTs are not the product. The product is community. So the NFT is a medium to build a community. Yeah, I'm launching, you know, my first project right now, where we're kind of reimagining the, you know, most epic music festival. You know, 100,000 people, 50,000, 200,000, whatever the community decides. But there are going to be 3,000 founders, and we are going to decide together, one vote, one token, one vote, what this festival is going to become. But in that case, the NFT and the festival itself is, they're just mediums to create a community. So when you went to VCon, you realize, oh, wow, like you should go to a festival and you start building relationships. That was a culmination of relationships, right? Like we all knew people in our sub communities who we met up with there. It was not the beginning of relationships. And so the energy comes from that group of people bouncing off each other. Like in many ways, it's the streets of New York back when I actually like spent time like meeting entrepreneurs. And like you basically, as Scott Galloway would call it, a bunch of electrons like bouncing off each other, right? Like ideas, and you know, you'd have a meeting, and you know, you'd introduce that person to five people. They would introduce you, and then you'd just hop into another meeting, and like there's like this energy builds. That's what these crypto communities feel like, where like good ideas rise to the top, good people, you know, are rewarded. A lot of the scammy stuff is not in the community, but around the community, right? Like people trying to like take advantage of your connection with that community by getting you to connect your wallet. And for me, it's been a lot of positivity. I'm just doing my first project, so I'm sure I'm going to get crushed like a lot of my like entrepreneurs that I respect. Like I've seen G-Funk and John Crane and, you know, Danny with his project, Party Degenerates, and Kevin Rose at, you know, First Proof Collective and Moonbirds. Like, yeah, it's kind of rough. I compare it to like not running a public company, but running a company in public. So it takes a constitution personally, you know, of the founder to kind of, you know, do that and be transparent and speak your mind, but not be afraid to like tell the community why they're wrong. Like you listen to a lot of like the great entrepreneurs, a lot of their time is like talking people off the ledge. It's Gary Vee saying, if you just want to focus on floor prices, I'm not your guy. Like I'm building this for the next 50 years and I'm playing the long game. I'm not like, whether you're underwater this week or next week, I can't, like, it's just can't worry about it.
What do you think? Because obviously I've heard Gary yelling a lot about most of these projects are going to go to zero. What's going to differentiate the ones that don't go to zero? Is it going to be that long-term mindset of you're building it for 50 years or what, especially when you're looking at projects, like what do you think is going to separate those ones that do survive?
To me, it's so obvious. And I could be wrong, but it's no different than why businesses succeed today for the long term. And to me, it just comes down to the customer, which is really the community. And I say the community because it's not kind of a transactional relationship where like I buy this product from you, you know, I give you money, I get the product. It's a very tough thing to destroy. That's not true. It's easy to destroy early on, but if you build a community that survives without your involvement, you can have a project, a business that lasts forever. And so, you know, Superfest, which is, you know, my project with three, I'm doing it with my friends at Superfly. And I've known Superfly since 2009 Bonnaroo. They created Bonnaroo soon after they graduated from Tulane. It's been 20 years. And this year's Bonnaroo will be one of the best ever. Check out the lineup. You know, check out the programming. Now, this is in the middle of nowhere. It's actually 2 hours outside of the middle of nowhere. So you fly into Nashville, and you drive to Manchester, Tennessee. There have been years where it's 110 degree heat. I've camped out with my kids, you know, when basically we couldn't stay in the tent for fear of like overheating. Why does it work, right? It's a community. It's a community with values. You know, number one for them is radiate positivity. People feel great when they come to the farm. You know, it's people taking care of other people. 100,000 people camping out in the middle of Tennessee. Got to be hydrated, got to be fed. You got to stay safe. You got to take care of your brothers and sisters, right? And so when I look at projects that are going to survive, they look like those communities. They may not come back every year to Bonnaroo, but that feeling they get, the friends that were made, the families created, the babies that were made at Bonnaroo. If you went to VCon, that's what was happening. Like I've been married forever. But like the parties and like all that stuff, like these are relationships that will end up in marriages. Some of them will have babies. It's hard to, you know, overstate how incredible that is for people and how it keeps this business moving forward. And VCon's a business. VFriends is a business. But they've taken the core customer, the community member, put her in the center and said that we are going to build this with you, for you. And that was the feeling I think we all got, which we didn't know what to expect. But after like a few hours, like, oh, this is what this is. This is connecting with like-minded people. Like, that's cool. That's something you can't buy. And I think when you look at the projects that are doing this, that's what it's about. It's about like using whatever the content is, the commerce, the gaming aspect, using that to drive community.
And how do, because so it simplification answer is that it's the projects with the tightest communities that are going to survive. But building a tight community is easier said than done. Do you need a compelling story that the community rally around? Like in your experience, what do you need in order to create and foster a meaningful community?
I mean, the most important thing that you need are like-minded people who share similar interests. And so very large businesses have been created over the years around that. Now, I'm not here to dissect VFriends and their community, but I think a lot, what I got is a lot of these community members are aspirational. They want to do better for their families. They want to get, you know, they're upwardly mobile, meaning like wherever they are, they're hustling to get like somewhere else. They want to pick other people up. And that's what that community is about. There's a reason that my first project is in music. I love music. I've been to 200 Phish concerts. You know, don't laugh, but it's what I love. And music has been a way that many different types of people have created communities. And so do I think we could create a tight community around music in a way that our community members feel they're creating it and their lives are better because of it, that they have, you know, we're already having dozens of people who met through our Discord who are now going to shows together in New York and LA. Like I went to the Phish show and ran into a bunch of community members. We hung out. We'll be at Bonnaroo where we're doing a meetup of about 200 people who we've actually given Bonnaroo tickets to in the community just to come hang out, right? Like build relationships. Now, yeah, we're lead investor in Series A of Tom Brady and, you know, Rich and Dylan Rosenblatt's company Autograph. Like sports is another area. People create, you know, any Ranger fan after last night, like feels the love, right? I'm not a Rangers fan, but I live in New York. And as long as the Capitals aren't in, I'm a Rangers fan. But like that's community, right? Like, the Rangers are not monetizing just because of commerce. They're monetizing this feeling of being a fan. Like, what are the other areas? You know, I think Kevin Rowe's doing a great job with, like, you know, knowledge. So Proof Collective was basically the whole idea is that we will help you be a better collector, right? Then he moved on to how do we give, you know, people in our community an identity, Moonbirds. How do we, and so we'll see what they do next. But, you know, for me, I'm newer in kind of the builder side. So, you know, Kevin had distribution, the podcast. He's like been such a giver to artists and a supporter of artists. And I think what I'm most focused on is just people who know how to execute. And when I say that, I mean, it's not easy. Like, we are going to have 3,000 founders of our festival, Superfest. We could go out and we could market it to influencers and we could get people to sign up. We're inviting those founders in one by one. Like literally, are these people who like music? Are they creative? Have they been to festivals? Do they want more out of the festivals that they have been to? What are things we can do that no one's ever tried at festivals? And so we're basically crafting a group of 3,000 people who are going to create something that's like so much better than Woodstock. Like Woodstock, for the people who went there, they actually say they were miserable. Like, we talked to people who actually went to Woodstock. Like, if they were there, they're like, oh, it was an experience, but I was fucking miserable. Like, wet, cold. Like, I just couldn't move. I was hungry because they hadn't figured out food. Like, we want a lot of the same vibes, but like, totally awesome. Like, everything, like what we got out of VCon was so interesting. It was like, oh, that's a like business conference. You could sit down and talk to someone. There's plenty of room. And there was energy. There were things to do at night if you wanted to party or if you just wanted to have dinner with a smaller group. Right? So it wasn't about, I kind of love that they didn't go out and get Springsteen. I forget who they even had as like the musical guest. Like, I can't remember because it wasn't about them. Yeah.
Wyclef Jean, was that the Friday night? I think.
Maybe. I don't even know because it wasn't about that. Like, it's not about a bunch of people watching one person. It's about how do we all interact? And so that's kind of, you know, going back to your community, like, you got to have a reason for being. I like communities that are on a mission. I love Linksdale. Like Mike Dudas, like, we're going to buy a golf course. We're going to make it fun because golf kind of sucks, right? You got to wear fancy clothes and it's all stuffy and like game on, right? Like, I don't mind playing golf. I just don't love like all the rules around it. Like, that's like a good mission for a golf community, right? Like, let's build a course that we love and we'll all participate and have a sense of ownership. Now, they're not going to own the golf course because, like, you know, we live in the US and got to abide by securities regulations, all that stuff. But like, if you help make the rules and like you can show up with your friends and have fun, like, what's the ROI of that? A lot.
And so you mentioned a little bit ago how you're new to building in the NFT space. You did a lot of investing. You were very early when it came to investing. So I'm curious why you waited until now to start building. Why not build sooner?
I mean, mainly because, you know, I needed to learn. I didn't have ideas or a structure that made sense. I needed to get through, you know, what we've done, what I've done. If I look at like me as a collector and as an investor, is I started from like, oh, I'm the customer, the community member, to I'm helping founders navigate their worlds. And, you know, the most recent one was Pixel Vault, which I couldn't be more bullish on. It's going to be the summer of Pixel Vault. You know, as I tweeted out last week, I spent, you know, a lot of time with G-Funk last week. And like, the guy's like, you know, he's a brilliant game theory guy who happens to know, you know, he's a business degree, a law degree. He knows how to execute. Most of these don't. Most of the founders don't, which is why they're not going to be around. For me, you know, when you're a fiduciary, a registered investment advisor, like, we're really focused on, you know, building the business of stewarding other people's money. I needed something that Velvet C could really get behind. And so this is something that I'm doing, but also it's a business. Right now, we're going to be very transparent. We're going to spend, you know, 75%, 80% of all the funds on the actual festival. And, you know, we're starting with music, but we're going to do other types of experiences as well. My partner in that is Superfly. That's Bonnaroo, Outside Lands, the Friends Experience. They just launched the Prince Experience. So, like, they know how to get like 100,000 people in and out safely. They like, I needed a partner that could actually produce. I don't want to do like a 1,000-person event. We want to do like an epic cultural festival, like something that changes culture in the way that we want to change culture. When I say we, the community, because I just have one vote. And so there's a little Burning Man, there's a little Bonnaroo, there's a little like VCon in there. And so for me, it all came together with like, great partners. I've been, you know, partner of Superfly and investor in Superfly since their first round. You know, I stalked them. I didn't know who did this. After I went to Bonnaroo, I actually reached out and I'm like, I love you guys. Got to meet you. Literally, I was like, I have to meet you. Like, I love this event so much. I just need to meet you. Like, there's no saying no. Like, I don't care when, where, just say. And then we became friends. Yeah, I did it mainly because, like, I'm like, oh, I'll just be friends and get free tickets. But I just love them, and they needed help with social media. They needed, so, like, yeah, I don't look at things as transactional. Like, they had needs, and they thought I could maybe help, and I had needs. I got to get tickets, this thing. And I don't, like, you can't force projects or businesses. Every time you do something for money or because, like, oh, I got nothing else going on, so you got to do it. Like, I've learned enough that you have to, like, sit with something for not just, like, a night, but, like, write it down on paper. If you're still excited tomorrow about it, talk to someone. If you're still excited in a week, maybe talk to a few more. If you're still excited in a month, you may have something there. This has been brewing on my side for months. On the Superfly side, they've always wanted to do a community-run festival. They're in the community business. They book bands at Tipitina's while they're at Tulane. There are four of them. Like, they're in the business of bringing people together. And I think we all are very disillusioned with the state of the festival world. Like, you know, GovBall and all these things have the same lineup, right? It's like, line up, here are the tickets. We'll have a bunch of vendors for food. They're all the same. So we want to break out of that. And, like, what if you didn't have to rely on, like, a big name and paying them $1 million to show up to sell tickets? What if you could just, like, program what you want and you don't have to worry about the tickets because the community is programming what they want and they'll bring friends. Now, can we get 100,000 of their friends or 200,000 or 1 million eventually? Who knows? But I think it would be really cool to try.
What are some of the biggest things you've learned going from investor collector to founder builder in the NFT space?
So I'm still learning. Like, we have, end of June, we have our founders mint where, like, the super pass, you know, the only time you'll ever be a founder where you, 3,000 passes where you can, like, get access to the private Discord and actually get a vote in the governance of this thing. We're spending a lot of time getting that right. And frankly, there's a lot of people I'm not reaching out to. Like, we don't want, like, clearly with all of our network, we could sell like 20,000 of these. Like, all the people we've mentioned here, plus all the people we've helped. We're not doing that. There's no public sale. We're just getting people together who, it's kind of like I keep saying, we're putting stuff out in the world slowly. And then people who want to join are reaching out to us. And so by the time we mint, it's, you know, we have a super list that basically gives them, that's when the work starts. And if you just ask, maybe I'll come back on in a year. Because what I do know is shit goes down with companies. Like, this is not like, very few things are up and to the right. I have like one company I've invested in out of like 80 that's like literally from the beginning up and to the right every year. It's like, okay. Startups are a series of things going bad. And hopefully every now and then something goes well enough to justify keep going. But they make no sense, like, in general. And that's why 9 or 10 of them fail. And so we're not taking anything for granted. I think the way we're approaching it is optimizing for community, optimizing for that core group. If we get the core group right and we do our work, which is like, we're going to be educating them on the trade-offs of a music festival. Like, there are some natural trade-offs. Yeah, you could have like Bruce Springsteen and Kanye or Ye, but, you know, it'll cost $2 million each. And is it better to spend $4 million on two people performing? Or would you rather have the most epic, like, midnight dance parties that are, each of them are costume parties where people can come dressed as their favorite, like, you know, PFP project, whatever. Like, I'm just like, it's not an idea. I'm just like riffing, right? Like, do you do it at a location that has infrastructure or not? And there's big trade-offs and costs associated with that. Like, yeah, Bonnaroo's awesome, but it wasn't always awesome before showers and before like bathrooms. Like, they built infrastructure there. So like, yeah, we could have it in like Joshua National Park, but like, what's the trade-off? So we're going to, like, part of it's going to be educating people about like, what is the P&L, a profit and loss statement for a festival? Because if it's not healthy financially, you're not going to be able to do it, right? And so we're going to take them from there to hopefully by the end of the year, we're going to have it 80% baked. So then we could like offer it to the world, say, hey, these 3,000 epic people created something that's unique. Do you like it? If so, mint this NFT, will give you access to the inaugural event. Our goal is to create the feelings that many of us had at VCon. Like, it's a feeling. It's a feeling we're after, not just like the Instagrammable moment. Like, so many young people I see with my kids, they are miserable trying to get that one moment for social media. The ideal festival for me, no phones. You go to a fish show, and I took a bunch of pictures, ironically. You look forward, there's no one with their phone out. People are in the moment, connecting with the art, connecting with others. That, like, if people could show up at an event and have 3 days without a phone, or you have to go somewhere to use it just to, like, there may be an emergency, whatever, that would be fucking awesome. And people would feel so replenished, and, like, they would kind of retox after this, like, you know, or detox after this kind of, like, you know, electronic barrage we all live under. But who knows? A community could say, we want to give away free phones to everyone who attends. So what the fuck, right? Like, we're placing our, we'll execute whatever they want, but we're placing our trust in these 3,000 people, which is why we're trying to, like, get people who are somewhat interested in the creation and not just the attendance.
That is a profound statement, though, that people now go through so much pain and misery just for that one Instagrammable moment. How do we change, how do we shift that as a culture to wanting to have good energy and enjoy the moment more than just all the pain and misery for one photo?
I actually don't know. I mean, I've pulled back significantly after having helped create this stuff, right? Like, Buddy Media was all about birds of a feather flock together. How do you get people to share to get more people into your business's orb? And a lot of what we did, and it's still being done, is like these dopamine hits that really turns out aren't great for not only kids' mental health and our mental health, but also democracy and all that stuff that we've ruined. And so that's the big, your questions that I think one of the big questions of our generations, how do you cure cancer and how do you cure, you know, electronic addiction, which we all have. I don't think it's by going cold turkey. I don't think it's a coincidence that the biggest mental health crisis that the youth of this country has ever had coincides with the rise of these devices. And I love technology and I don't want to see it go away. So I've spent a lot of time thinking about that, but I don't think it's about regulating certain platforms or, you know, adding like, oh, you only have 4 hours on the device. I think the way it works is if whatever the young people and women do, the rest of society follows. So the history of the internet is like, oh, get like the young people and the women, and then you get the old people and the dudes. It's how Facebook grew. It's how Instagram grew. It's how AOL grew. Like, the focus is on like this youth culture. And I think if there were a movement that made being present cool. It would really help. And I think Gary's doing a lot, you know, with his positivity and like being present. At the same time, he's addicted to the phone. Text him right now. He's going to respond right away. So it's hard. Like all technology is impregnated with good and bad, right? It could be used for good. It could be used for bad. Turns out that people who use it for bad are much better at using it than the people who use it for good historically. So Cambridge Analytica using the Facebook platform was much better than Buddy Media. We were selling like philanthropy and drinks and like cars. They were selling the end of democracy, and they turned out to be really good at doing that. They're not the first who had nefarious plans to use technology effectively.
I know we're a little over time here, so I'm going to jump to my last question, but I just want to thank you for taking time to come on the show. I've learned a lot. I'm going to be working on a new project in the NFT and crypto space. So there's a lot of stuff you've given me here that I'm going to be digesting on and thinking about for a while after we finish recording here. But the last question that I ask anybody at the end of every interview is, I actually like to flip the script. So instead of me asking the question, it's you asking the question, but it's not to me. Pretend you have a crystal ball. You can ask this crystal ball any question. You'll get the 100% honest answer. What is one question you want to know the answer to?
The one question that I'm constantly asking is, which it really isn't an answer that I'm going to get from everyone in your group, but it's, are you working on the right things? Like, I see so much effort being wasted by people working on just problems that don't exist, projects that they hate. Literally, like a lot of founders in the NFT space feel like they have an albatross around their neck. I'm like, do something about it. Tell the community, be like, find a community member to run with it. But really, are you working on the right project for you? And that's like, if you can find the right projects, the right companies, the right, however you define your life, everything else takes care of itself. And like most companies get in trouble because they don't focus on the right stuff. Facebook almost didn't make it. They didn't have a mobile strategy when they went public. So they hadn't focused on that than they did. I think tuning into like, how are you spending your time? What are your priorities? Are they the right priorities? Is the most interesting question that I, you know, ask all of the founders I'm blessed to work with.
I like that. That's a great question, a great place to end off. I want to thank you once again for taking time to come on the podcast. I want to give you the floor now. Where can the people find you? Where can they find Superfest? Plug anything and everything you got right now.
Yeah. Just Twitter at Lazero. That's where LAZEROW. That's where most of us degens hang out. So I've opened DMs. Please connect with me. And happy to send you information on Superfest. We've made it pretty hard to find on purpose. So it's Superfest with a 3.xyz. So, and we haven't added a lot of the Google, metadata specifically. But once we kind of get to this minute, we'll open it up and we have a better URL and everything.
Gotcha. Well, I'll make sure everything's linked in the show notes down below so people can find it. I want to thank you once again for taking time to come on the podcast. I want to thank everybody for listening, whether you listen the entire way through or you only listen to Bits and Pieces. I really appreciate you for taking time to check this out. Do me a big favor, go and follow Michael on Twitter. Go and check out Superfest. I'll make sure everything's linked in the show notes down below so you can find it. If you'd like to follow me, you can find me everywhere on social media at the Jacob Kelly. Feel free to come and say hello. My DMs are always open. As always, today's podcast is powered by Surf. Thank you once again for listening. We'll talk soon.